And now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Carol from Bakersfield. And as you heard, 34 years, 364 days. Let's give it up for Carol.
Hi, everybody. My name is Carol, and I am an alcoholic. And I hope that God shows up and works through me, because I don't have anything to say. I can tell you that from the beginning. I want to welcome all the newcomers. I also like to always welcome, maybe there's one or two or three or four of you that didn't stand up to let us know who you are or where you are, because you haven't decided that this is where you want to be, or this is maybe even where you ought to be. I want to welcome you too, because one of the things I always tell people is that if you're sitting out here and you don't know whether or not you're in the right place, if you don't know whether or not you're an alcoholic, keep coming back. You can keep coming back and listening with an ear to hear, and perhaps you'll hear something that you'll relate to, perhaps you won't. But what I can tell you is that whatever decision you make, ultimately, whether it's to stay or to go, will affect the entire rest of your life in one way or another. So I hope you stay. Because I say that because that was me when I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know whether I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And so people told me to keep coming back anyway. And that's what I did, because I somehow intuitively knew that if I left at that time, that I may not have another opportunity to come into the program again and do something. So I'm glad I made the decision, so I urge you to do that. I want to congratulate all the CHIP people and all the birthday people. Those are big deals. It doesn't matter whether it's 30 days, 4 days, or 43 years. Congratulations to all of you. I've been thinking lately, because I've got this birthday tomorrow, and I've been thinking back to 1983. My sobriety date is August 30th, 1983. My sponsor is, I have a sponsor, her name is Karen Hendricks in Bakersfield. She's got 45 years of sobriety. And I have a home group. It's a Saturday Select Speakers Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets every Saturday night at 3700 Union Avenue, Northminster Presbyterian Church. And if you get a chance to come down and be in Bakersfield on a Saturday night, please come join us. It's a great meeting and it's great fellowship, and I have some wonderful speakers coming up there. And so back in 1983, January 9th, 1983, I'm going to give away my age. I was turning 36 years old that night, that day, and I was depressed because I hadn't even begun to live, and 36 was going to put me on the dying side of living. That's what I called it, the dying side of living. And I was lamenting my whole life and how little time I had left. And what I wasn't aware of at that time was that I was at a threshold that was going to change my life. And I didn't know it. And I'm so grateful for that. And if I live to January 9th, 2019, I can say that my life at that point in 1983 wasn't quite half over. And if I make it to another birthday next year, I will have lived more than half of my life in sobriety. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, I've got about half an hour to share, and what I can tell you is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came through a court card. It's my second DUI, whatever you call those today. And the first one I had, I thought the Highway Patrol was making everything up that he wrote in his report. But I knew I was in trouble that first time when I got stuck on the ABCs and got hauled off to Sybil Brand. That was my second time at Sybil Brand in my life, and I wasn't any too happy about it. I was bailed out by my stepsister, who came down there and picked me up. And I remember that when I signed my discharge, I was so mad that I just used the whole 8.5 by 11 page and wrote my signature across the whole thing, because how dare they do this to me. And my second 502, I was actually on my way to the police department because I was in the process of being followed by somebody. And long story short, what had happened was that about 4 or 5 months earlier, I was living in Hollywood. I was robbed as I was going in from a date, and I were robbed as I was going into my apartment building. And so with that, I fled my protection from that first 502. I fled to San Fernando Valley, and I knew when I made that move, it was only going to be a matter of time before I picked up another driving under the influence. And so I thought it would take a little longer than I don't think it took more than a couple, few months. And so I had that that night that I got that second 502. I'd been out drinking. I hit a car as I was backing out of the driveway, but I was okay. And I'm driving home, and I get home, and this car's following me, and I get into my driveway, and the car stops behind me. So I get scared. I back out. I hit her car. So bottom line was, we're driving up Roscoe, one of those big Van Nuys Boulevard in Panorama City, Van Nuys, and we're driving up there, and we reach a point where I stopped my car in the middle of the street, she stopped hers behind me, and we're just stuck there, and then the police came, and they got, actually arrested both of us. That was the 502 that sent me to court, and I fought the 502 because I didn't want, if I was going to be found guilty of a DUI or a reckless driving, I was, because that's held as a prior, I was going to be found guilty of the real thing, and maybe I wouldn't be found guilty at all, but that didn't happen. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, my life was in shambles as far as I was concerned. I thought my outsides looked okay and I looked like I was somewhat put together, but I really wasn't. It took me some time in sobriety before I could look in a mirror and see what I really looked like. And the actions that I took when I was drinking, you know, I told somebody in that first who 12-stepped me into the program while I was going on the court card that I had to drink to live and do the thing, to live the way I did and do the things I did. And it wasn't until I got here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I discovered that that wasn't necessarily true. The God I came in here with was a God that I couldn't stand, didn't want anything to do with. In fact, the bailiff outside in the lobby of the Van Nuys courthouse in that second 502 suggested that the jury could go one way or the other, guilty or not guilty, and if I just went home and said a prayer to God, that God might intervene and bring in a not guilty verdict for me. I wasn't about to do that because in 1978 I learned that my mother had cancer, and I turned away from God mentally, emotionally, any way I could. I didn't want anything to do with this God that would do this to my mother, who'd had a hard enough life as far as I was concerned. And what I didn't tell the bailiff was that I wasn't going to do it. I just said okay, because that's what I did, because I didn't want anybody to know what was going on inside of me. The insides were basically void of any feeling, any semblance of life. I was getting up day by day, going through the motions of whatever it was I had to do. I had a job that wasn't I don't call it a real job, because I was being paid under the table. I was down to working 3 days a week for a really good lady. And she was paying me under the table as a contractor, which I wasn't reporting. And you know, I was involved with married men. I had done a lot of things that I wasn't proud of. I'd been in jail 3 times. I had nothing on my insides left. I was basically breathing in and out, hoping that I could go to sleep tonight and not have to wake up tomorrow morning, because I was too scared or too, I just didn't know how I could take my own life. And the truth is that not only did I not know that I could do that, but I always worried about my sister, that I was afraid what would happen to her. What would she think if I committed suicide and killed myself? What would she do? My dream was always to get in the car, find a cliff or a brick wall that I could just ramp, build up speed in the car and just ram into that brick wall and be done with it. That's all I wanted. So I just prayed every night that I could go to sleep and maybe not have to wake up tomorrow morning and go through the same thing another day. And Another day of knowing how worthless I am. Another day of knowing how I use people. Another day of not wanting to pick up a drink, but somebody suggesting let's go out for a drink, because I said that morning to myself, perhaps, that, you know, today I'm not going to drink today. I knew I could never not drink ever. That never occurred to me, that I would get a call after I'd wake up, head hanging on the side of the bed, thinking, my mom didn't raise me to live this way. What if, you know, I'm so glad she doesn't know how I'm living. You know, I was devoid of anything on the inside. I was breathing in and out, and I wouldn't stop, and I kept waking up. And when somebody would call to say, do you want to go for a drink? It didn't matter what I said that morning. If they called and said, asked if I wanted a drink, I said, sure, let's go. And that's what my life was like. It was nothing. I had no friends. I didn't want anybody to find out who I really was, because if you knew who I really was, you wouldn't want anything to do with me. You wouldn't want me in your life. You wouldn't. Holidays, I was always alone. Always alone, and I couldn't get anybody, manipulate anybody into being around or doing anything for me. And I was really tired. And somewhere along the way, I'd heard that if I take a diet pill in the morning and a diet pill at night, that I can get a little bit of sleep and still get up and make it to the job on time. So that's what I started doing, because that's the kind of information I put in my head and keep it there for future reference. And so when this woman I was working for said, if you don't start getting here on time, I'm going to have to fire you, I started taking the diet pill in the morning and then the diet pill at night before I went to bed, and drink in between time after I got off work, and do what I thought I had to do. And so by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a God, I didn't have a life, I didn't have anything in me to give away, to have you reach in and take from me. There was just nothing left. I was a shell, and I refer to myself as a walking zombie, because that's the way I felt. And so when I came to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sentenced to 6 meetings, and among other things. And when I came to that first meeting, I had been fighting it because I didn't want to be here. I didn't want you to think I was an alcoholic, and I know this is a secret organization. You don't want me to know who you are. So why would you want me here? And it's not like in a small town. Los Angeles is Los Angeles. I wouldn't know my neighbor if they were standing next to me. And so I had told this woman who knew about, it wasn't my last drunk, but the one I remember the most was getting to work on time. I'd been out drinking the night before. I had said, don't let me have any more than 2 drinks because I have to get up and go to work. It was one of the 3 days I had to go to work the next day. And I didn't make it. I got sick during the night. I woke up just barely enough time. By this time, I'd also started carrying makeup and a change of clothes in my car in case I didn't make it home. And so I got into work, and on the way into work, I keep smelling this stench all around the car, and I don't know what it is. And I get into work, and it follows me in. My boss, who is a property manager and always working in the field, was in the office all damn day. And I could not write. I couldn't hold my head up. I couldn't do anything. And as I'm straightening up my hair and pulling, because it was long at that time, pulling it out of my face, I feel this goop in my hair. And that's when I realized that what I've been smelling is the vomit that I'd thrown up the night before. And so I went through the day feeling like I'd just gotten up off the bar. I didn't go to the bar that night. And so I told her before I came to my first meeting, I said, I just decided last night that I could do this one of 2 ways. I could go to these meetings and stand against the wall, dare you to have anything to do with me, shut my ears, shut my eyes, and just be bodily there and not participate in any way, even by listening. Or I could go to these meetings and listen to what you had to say, because I went to a speaker meeting, and listen to what you had to say, and maybe I could figure out why my brothers drink the way they do and what I could do to make them stop. Now, what I will tell you about my brothers is that I'm the oldest of five kids. I had three brothers and a sister. And it went me, my sister, and my three brothers. And those three brothers that I came here to listen to what I could do to make them stop drinking. My oldest little brother died in 2000. Last time I talked to him for his birthday in December, he turned 49. He said, "Carolyn, I didn't think I'd ever live long enough to see 50. And he died in April the following year. All, as far as I'm concerned, a direct result of his alcohol and drug use. Weakened his body, and it finally just gave out on him. And my baby brother was a stone alcoholic, started drinking, was 9 years old, lived in Tampa, Florida, and I'm in a meeting in Visalia a few years ago, and my middle little brother calls me, and he said the police were just at the door, and they found Rick, my baby brother. He'd been lying in a pond behind a medical facility for quite some time, and the story we pieced together was that he had been arrested and taken to the medical facility on the day after Thanksgiving the year previous. And they didn't admit him because they identified him because he had the wristband on his arm. And he left the facility and walked across the highway. And before he got past the pond in the field that was in an island, whatever happened to him, happened to him. And as I like to call it, he died an alcoholic death. He was alone. There was nobody to bother to report him missing. They didn't find him until early February. And so he'd been laying there all that time, whether he convulsed, whether he had a heart attack, whether he was drowned in the water. Nobody knows. He was too decomposed for anybody to find out. But that's the alcoholic death that awaits for me. That's what waits for me. My middle little brother is still living. He's back in Ohio. He's drinking because he doesn't want to stop drinking, but he's just been diagnosed with cancer, and I'm hoping that I can be there to walk the path with him regardless of what happens to him. And the program has made it possible for me to want to do that. The program has made it possible for that to happen. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous not an alcoholic, but I've stayed because I am an alcoholic. I did the work that was necessary for me to find out for myself without having to go back out again and try it so far. And that happened when I finally sat down and started doing the writing that I needed to do. And my first sponsor told me to write a drunkalog. Well, I didn't really want to do that, but what happened when I you know, the stuff hits the fan and you either decide to do the work or go get drunk. And so whenever that has happened, so far I've been willing to do the work that's necessary to keep me here and change my life. And so that was my first thing. Step one was admitted I was powerless over alcohol. I had no idea what powerlessness meant. I wasn't powerless. I could walk away from a drink, I thought, until I started putting it on right in paper. And what I discovered when I put it on paper is that when I picked up a drink, the drink had me. And I no longer could control how much I drank, what I was going to do, where I was going to wind up, or who I was even going to wind up with. And I saw that time after time after time in the episodes that I put on paper. And once I could see that that's what happened to me, because if you read the big book and the doctor's opinion, which I just reread a couple of days ago, it talks about the allergy. And the allergy occurs for me once I ingest the drink. If I don't ingest the first drink, I'm okay. I'm except that I have the mind that says it's 3 o'clock, it's almost time for a drink. And I start counting the time when I can go into the office and get a drink or get home or go somewhere after. So it's a mind thing. And I did not know any of this. I did not know. I started planning my drink long before I picked it up. And once I saw that, I realized that I am an alcoholic. Now, I went to a women's stag meeting in Sherman Oaks, and these were wonderful women. They walked me into sobriety. And they talked talked in that meeting about knowing that they were alcoholic. They said it moves from here, where you mentally, you know up here in your head that you're alcoholic, but they knew it somewhere deep inside their gut, and I didn't know how they knew. They said, you keep coming back, and you'll know when it happens. It's called the last 18 inches. And it happened for me when I began to see the truth of my drinking on paper. Everything that I've seen about myself, I've seen when I put it on paper, because I cannot lie on paper. And that was the start of my journey. And what has happened for me over time, you know, I had my last drink actually on August 18th, 1983, and it was 10 days later. I was sitting at the Valley Club, and this woman who volunteered to be my sponsor asked me if I was taking anything or doing anything besides drinking. Well, I wasn't going to tell her that I was also taking diet pills morning and night, but when she asked me, it was like this little voice from inside that wanted to live popped out of me, and my answer, what came out of, rolled out of my mouth, was yes. She said, what is it? And I said, well, I take a diet pill at night and I take one in the morning. She said, why don't you go home tonight? It was August 29th. Don't take a diet pill tonight and don't take a diet pill tomorrow morning. So August 30th became my sobriety date. That lady walked me through coming into becoming willing to find a God that will work for me. Because as I said, I wanted no part of God, and every time I sat in meetings and you talked about God, my skin would crawl, my stomach would churn, but I'd sit there with a smile on my face because, like always, I don't want you to know that I'm rejecting what I'm hearing. And because I need to people please and know that you accept me, and I can't let you know that that's what's going on. And she one night said to me, Carol, have you asked God to remove the obsession to drink? And I said, it might work for you guys, but it won't work for me. She said, Carol, go home tonight. I want you to get on your knees. Now, I didn't really do that, but I wasn't going to go that far. But I want you to go home, and I want you to ask God to remove the obsession to drink. So I said, okay. And to myself, I thought, I'll show you. It works for you. It won't work for me, and I'll prove it to you. So I went home that night. I got in bed, and I got on my knees in bed, and I said this prayer. And out my window, there was a star in the sky, and that star became my representation of God. This was my beginning of a journey to my spiritual experience that I have today. And what I said in that prayer was God, I just asked God to remove any obsession, compulsion, and desire that I had to drink. Now, when I said that, it came from not here. It came from somewhere down here in my gut. And I was shocked that I meant it, that I really did want this thing called sobriety. I really did. I didn't know that I wanted sobriety, but I did know that I didn't want to drink again. And I got teary because it was such a shock to me. And that was the beginning of my journey to God. It can be that simple. You know, and I have not had to pick up a drink since then. And I'm grateful for that. God has grown over the years, and what I can tell you is that the God that is in my life today, you know, I started looking at, you know, I was thinking on the way up here, I don't know what I don't know until I know it. And I did not know the things that I did until I knew it. And what happened for me is that I would take an action that was normal to me. I was horrible with character assassination. I had to make you look bad so that it would make me look good. And I was always picking on somebody else and telling everybody else how bad they were. Until one day I did that and it didn't feel good anymore. And that's when Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to look at myself, and when I get uncomfortable with the action I'm taking, it's time to change the action. Now, I didn't always know how to change the action. That's when I listen to you in meetings. That's when I come to you and approach you after the meeting is over. How did you do that? How do I recognize that? What can I do? That's what worked for me. And, you know, I've come from somebody who was a people user, a manipulator, dead inside, and I'm still striving to be the person that God wants me to be. But I'm so far away from where I used to be. I'm not a people user. It took some time for me to do that. I was not marriage material when I got here. And I knew I wasn't marriage material. Nobody would want me if they knew the things I had done, the places I'd been, the people I'd been around. And I will tell you, I have to skip back, because on July 20th, 1967, and the date July 20th is important to my story. On July 20th, 1967, I gave birth to a child, and I placed him for adoption. And it was a date that I carried in shame for the longest time, for years. And every time July 20th came around, it was another reminder of how worthless I am. I can't even take care of a child. I can't even take care of myself. And today I'm grateful that I gave up that child for adoption, because in the middle of my drinking, which was just taking off at that time, he would have been the brunt of all of my anger and resentment. And I'm glad he wasn't there to experience that from me. But if I fast forward to 1986, I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's a fundraiser coming up at a women's recovery home in Reseda, and somebody is selling tickets, and I'm not interested in going, but the tickets she's got are ticket numbers 118 and 119. That year, that child was 18 years old, and on July 20th, he was going to be 19. The event was on July 20th. And so I bought the tickets with still no intention of going. Then a friend of mine says, oh, I can go with you. So I was kind of forced into it. So we went there, and I was introduced to a group of people from Bakersfield. And one of those was Ken Bilto. And 9 months later, we were married, and I moved to Bakersfield in March 21st, 1987. Now, before we got married, I wasn't marriage material. And before I got to Bakersfield, we're planning the wedding, and my head is telling me this isn't going to work. I have 2.5 years of sobriety. I said, this isn't going to work. And then my heart said, this is going to work. This is going to work. This is the right thing to do. And so I went through with it. And we had a great marriage. You know, I always said that I was constantly learning how to be married, because of and by myself, the only one I think about is me. And to meld that into being a couple, I sometimes have to think about somebody besides me, and that's really difficult. And I have to speed this up, because there's some things that happened that in my spiritual journey that I like to talk about. One is that in 1993, I needed to go home, and I made plans for a trip back. Home is in Ohio, and I made plans for a trip back in October. And I thought, that's going to be too late, because somebody's going to die, and that's too late in the year. I'm not going to make it in time. And because, you see, I always think I know who it is, what it is, what's going to happen, and everything else, you know. And I made it. Whatever family member was going to die hadn't died by then, so I made it. I went back there, and I spent some time with my sister, spent a week with her. She had switched from one day off to, she had arranged a 4 weeks vacation while I was there. So we spent the entire week together. Now, I did some things while I was back there that were unlike me. The day I got there, she was working, and so I went to the store. I got the stuff to make a lasagna dinner and salad and have everything ready for her when she got home. Now, when she got home, not only was dinner ready, I told her to have a seat because I was going to fix her plate and fix her meal for her. We went down to Kentucky to visit. It was important for me that she get down to Kentucky to visit my stepfather because I knew he was going to die. I didn't want her to feel guilty. So we visited him. We went to visit a friend down in Kentucky and drove back up. And we went for ice cream. And one of the things I always wanted, I had a sponsor once for a short time just before I met Ken, and she talked once about accepting her family exactly as they were, and I thought, oh my God, I would love to do that. I'd gone home way back in my early sobriety, and I devastated my sister. I hurt her so bad, I didn't think I could ever face her again, because I always needed to be more important than anybody else. I needed to let her know at that particular time that somebody thought more of me than they did of her, and that isn't the case at all, but that's what I wanted to prove to her. And somebody gave me something, and they said, don't let her know because I don't have anything for her. And I said, don't worry about it. So I go home, I'm staying with her, and I put it on top of her chest in the room I'm staying in, and she walks in, and what's the first thing she sees? In that moment of recognition, the only thing I know to do is get honest with myself and realize what I've just done. And I can't run and I can't hide. And I didn't think I could ever face her again. And when I got home from that trip, the only thing I knew to do was to send the thing to her because it was void of any meaning to me at that point in time. Her relationship and our relationship together was the most important and valuable thing in my life. I didn't know until years later, this 1993, that when she got that thing on Christmas Day, she thought that I was giving it to her because I was about to kill myself. And I said, no, that wasn't it at all. And when I left her to go back down to spend the last night with my stepfather, I nearly pulled off the side of the road. I was sobbing so, and that was unusual because I hadn't cried when I left home for a really long time. I went down to Kentucky and spent the next night with my stepfather, and when I left him to go to the airport to fly back to Bakersfield, I didn't cry. I had no emotion whatsoever, and I thought, this is really weird because this is the last time I'm going to see him. And when I got home, I was telling Ken about how fabulous the trip was because I accepted my sister, her kids, her husband, everybody exactly as they were. The first time that I consciously knew that I did that. And it was wonderful, and I couldn't wait to go back there again. I couldn't wait to go back there and do it again with her. And then 3 weeks later, the call came. The family member died, and it was my sister. She was 45 years old and dropped dead of a heart attack. And in that moment of calamity and chaos and shock, I was standing in the bedroom and Ken was there, and around me I could feel the serenity and calmness of God's presence. And I knew that no matter what I was feeling, everything was exactly the way it was supposed to be. God had given me a gift of goodbye 3 weeks earlier that I did not recognize. That day I recognized as the gift of goodbye. And I'm so grateful that I could recognize it, that I could experience it. That is the first death I ever experienced in sobriety. And it speaks tributes to her and to this program that I was able and allowed to do that. I did not have to pick up a drink. I'm out of time, but very quickly, I'll tell you that my husband later was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I didn't want it to be Alzheimer's. I tried for it not to be Alzheimer's. I toted him from doctor to doctor to doctor, trying to make it something else for probably 3 years before I would finally accept the fact that he had Alzheimer's. And it got to the point where we had our regular meetings Friday and Saturday. And at the end of each of those meetings, we had our seats. And at the end of each meeting, Ken knew what his job was. It was to pick up and load the chairs onto the racks. And that's what we did. And eventually it got to the point where he began wandering. I called this one couple of guys that I knew, and one would pick up the other one, and the one, Tom, knew right where to go to find him. But he eventually had to be placed in a facility. But during those times, I would come home from work while he was still at the house, and he'd look at me and he'd say, "Well, who are you?" I'd say, "I had a sponsor at the time who kept reminding me early on, because, you know, it's always about me. It's always about me." And she reminded me, she said, "Carol, this isn't about you. He has a disease. And so this is about him and his disease. Stop and get out of yourself." And one day I got mad at him because he didn't take the pills they were supposed to take at noon, because I knew he did it just to make me mad. And he looked at me. He looked at me and he says, "I just forgot." I said, "Oh." Was the beginning of my acceptance and the change in our relationship, because when I came home, he would say things like, "Well, who are you?" And I'd say, "I'm your lovely wife of 20-some years." He'd look at me and smile. And believe it or not, those were good times. Sometimes he'd look at me and say, "How'd you know I was here?" I said, "I always know where you are, and I'm always going to be where you are." And when he went to the facility, I was there as often as I could be, and his last trip home was the Sunday of Columbus Day weekend in 2012, and it was a great day. I mean, it was just a great day, and 2 weeks later, that week, he started not eating. And I had decided to tell, I told the facility that if he didn't want to eat, it was okay, because it's his time. I had been praying to God for months, "Please let me know when to let go. Please let me understand when it's time." And the last week he was alive, I knew the end was near. And I kept asking God to... you know, I couldn't hear and understand what he was trying to say to me. And, you know, once again, I think it's about me, and it's not about me. And so I was laying next to him, and I had his hand, and I said, "I wish I could hear." This was on Wednesday. I wish I knew what I could say to help you. And out of his mouth came the last two words he ever said to me that I understood. And that was, "You are holding my hand, rubbing my arm, being here with me." And so when he passed on Sunday at 2 minutes after noon, I was there holding his hand, rubbing his arm. And that's a gift of the program. I could have missed all of this, because these were good times. In spite of everything, as a result of these deaths that I've had, the happy marriage, the day we got married, the good times that we've had, I'd have missed all of it. And I love feeling the pain as much as feeling the joy. Because when I'm feeling pain, I have something to share with you. When I feel the joy, I have something to share with you. That's what the program has done for me. It's taken me more out of myself than I ever thought was possible. It's allowed me to accept people. I was back home, and then I'll end with this because I'm way over, as I usually go. I was back home a couple of years ago. My middle little brother is still drinking, but he doesn't drink when I'm around. And one night I came home and he was drunk. And he started crying. He says, "I don't want you to see me this way." I said, "It's okay." I said, "I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here because I love you." Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do that. Has allowed me to accept my brother in his drinking or without his drinking, exactly as he is. He's a kind, loving human being, and God is a kind, loving power that has worked miracles in my life and allowed me to be willing and able to see things I was blind to before August 30th, 1983. I want to thank you for putting up with me, and hope somebody heard something. Thank you.